WQVL repeater system, good evening. The time is 7:20 p.m. Welcome to the WQVL repeater. This is the WQVL repeater. Good evening. Good evening. Connected. Disconnected.
Yes, that's your Gina. Thank you.
Good evening, WQVL repeater system. The time is 7:40 p.m. Connected.
T2YO, WHCDL. K2YO, WHCDL, if you were listening.
WHCDL, N2AJ.
Hey, how are you, Steve? WHCDL, just got in the car.
Roger, roger, Andy. Yeah, doing okay. It was just up in Hartford on my way back. Man, what a disaster it was with that. I heard they had a fire on the Throgs Neck Bridge on Friday. And they closed off the exit to it completely and totally so they could test it to see if it could handle the weight of commercial traffic, and what a disaster. It took me an hour and a half to go from where that ramp normally is for the Throgs Neck to go to the Whitestone. And it made my trip to Hartford a four-hour journey this morning. What a deal. On the way back, of course, this is a lot better, although we're crawling along here at 15 to 20 miles an hour. So, WA2CDL, N2AJ, back to you. WA2CDL, N2AJ, what happened to you, Andy? Must be phone call time.
Yeah, sorry, Steve. WHCDL had a phone call. You back?
Roger, roger. Yeah, I figured it was a phone call, Andy. You get that all the time.
It's okay. I heard what you said because I got caught up in it on Friday. It took me 2 hours to get where I had to go because I got stuck on the Cross Island that I went off the Cross Island onto Northern Boulevard and then had to weave my way around, and the traffic was just a mess because it spilled out into everything. So, because I had to see a customer on Friday. So I know that deal, and I didn't know if they were going to open it this weekend or test it or what. We'll have to check it out tomorrow because I pass that every day. All right, I'm just finishing up here. Actually, I'm in the car finally. I've been working on a project this whole weekend, which kind of tied me up a bit. I didn't want to spend as much time as I did, but I just about have it completed, so that's good. And at least now I can move forward from here. Because I want to get all these, I've had these projects on the back burner for a long time. I'm finally getting to them, and I'm finishing them up. Because there's other things that that I want to do. So I feel good that at least I accomplished what I wanted to do, but it took up the whole weekend, and didn't want to spend as much as I did, but I did.
Roger, Roger. Yeah, we won't tie it up much longer. Got the TechNet starting in, it looks like about seven, somewhere between 7 and 9 minutes. So, looks, I'm coming up to the Throgneck Bridge entrance, heading southbound onto the bridge. Now, this I understand is okay. I should be able to go over the bridge in this direction. If not, you'll hear me screaming. But, anyhow, that's how things are. Everything's okay other than that. Good to hear you're getting some projects done. Yeah, this is a great time of year to get them done. I've got the power washer ready to do some power washing, and I've got the trimmer ready to trim those high branches that are touching my dipole in the front yard, ready to go after that thing finally. Somebody lent me one of those extendable hedge trimmers things or whatever, the tree trimmer, tree pruner. That's about it. So, okay, good talking to you, and we'll catch you next time. WA2CDL, this is N2AJ.
Good. Yes, all my projects are outdoor projects, and that's what I need to do. So, it's working out good. All right. Yeah, I'm just about at my stop. So I will speak to you next time, and I'm going to leave the car for a while. I got to visit some people, and I'll see you later. Have a good one. Let me see you.
WX2N listening. Connected. Connected.
W2RFR mobile. Now, I heard you in the muck and mire there, but you were 98% static. Maybe if you try it again.
Okay, hopefully this is better. This is KC2OBG.
Jeff, haven't talked to you in so long. KC2OBG, how are you?
Okay, not bad. We only have a few minutes, so let's check. Okay, not bad. Hanging in there. Surviving in your time.
I only have a few minutes, too. My wife stepped into Dunkin' Donuts to get her daily coffee or her injection of coffee. I'm not sure how that's done.
I think it gets inhaled.
It probably can. So, I really haven't seen you in a long time. I haven't been to a club meeting for the whole year. And I haven't been to any of the activities. Have you?
No, I haven't. Busy working, and then busy not making any sales.
I'm sorry to hear that part. I remember when you got your new job. You still working in the city?
Next, tonight at 8 o'clock, welcome to the W2VL repeater.
No, not late on.
I heard you got laid off. Just heard that. I'm sorry to hear that. Apparently, I didn't realize the time. It's 8 o'clock, and Dick is going to come on. So I'm going to clear to the channel, and I'll talk to you again when you sound better and I can hear you better. Limit 2 RFR will be clear on your final. 73 Jeff. Talk to you soon.
73 Jeff. Catch you another time. Case 2 over to
Good evening. I'm K2 Romeo India Whiskey. I'm along with Mel, K2 Kilo Echo Yankee. At this time, we're going to begin the technical net. Main purpose of the technical net is to discuss ham radio subjects. Mel and Dick gather the clan. Hopefully some of those people listening tonight will have certain expertise in certain areas, and we'll all become a little bit smarter about this reasonably technical subject called ham radio and wireless technology. There's a lot to it. The schools don't teach enough of it. The books only partially cover the subject. You want a real person who understands radio and antennas and propagation, you hire a ham radio operator. That's the way you do it. Those are the people who've got the hands-on experience. They know how the stuff works. And by very few other means can you really get that particular body of knowledge. A person signs into the technical net by giving Mel and Dick your call letters, your name, and the word yes, which means you do have a question or a comment for the net. Do we have any check-ins at this time? Please give me your call letters and name.
W2OAY. Joe. Yes. Question and a comment.
Joe recognized one of our frequent sign-ins. Anyone else?
This is WS2N, Paul. With an Endeavour Space Shuttle Delay.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to hearing what the shuttle is doing and how you're getting the shuttle tonight. So far we got Joe and Paul. Anyone else?
N2AJ, Steve, no traffic and no expertise.
We need a few of those too, Steve. A lot of us have a lot of non-expertise in a lot of areas. The humble guys are the ones that can admit it. Okay, we got Joe, Paul, Steve. Anyone else to check in? Give me your call letters and name at this time.
KC2, UPP, Mike, no traffic.
Good evening all, K2, KEY.
Who was that masked man? Okay. We got Mike and Mel. One last call. Anyone else to give us a question or a comment tonight? Give me your call letters and name at this time.
KA2PYJ with a question.
2RFR, just listening, right?
KC2MDP, yes, with a question.
Okay, PAJ and MDP. PAJ, please tell me your name, sir.
Take the call as KA2PYJ. Name is John in Middletown, New Jersey.
Okay, John, and RFF, thank you, and MDP, I think you said you had a question, is that true?
Yes, I do, Dick. Name's Steve.
Okay, we got more than enough to get going tonight. Looks like the first sign-in was Joe, and go right ahead, Joe. And by the way, Joe, I guess it was on Thursday that you were getting some extended propagation on some of the UHF television channels, digital channels. I went and looked across my set and didn't see anything very unusual, unfortunately. You're on the South Shore, and I think the opening was reaching to you, and it didn't quite get to me. W2RYY, K2RYW.
That's rather unfortunate, because I was able to get that same station the next morning. It opened right back up, and I got that Channel 20 from North Carolina. I've got that station a couple of times already, so odd that I can get it and you can't. Anyway, that's not my question, though.
Let's hear your real question, Joe.
Okay, real question has to do with antenna efficiency. And I guess I ought to just ask the question, because it seems like if I give you too many details, it'll just clog everything up. But you can ask for details accordingly. An antenna that has a return loss that is higher than zero, but not very good at all, say like less than minus five but higher than zero, seems to radiate poorer with 20 watts than a comparable HC operating port, but a level of a half a watt. This is measured into a system that's using an RF link into a repeater system. Now, what other details need besides that?
Okay. You're in a slightly controversial area. I'm going to start off by going to the best Bible on the subject I know of. In the case of antenna efficiency, the IEEE Special Technical Group on Antennas and Propagation, it's called the IEEE AP, Antennas and Propagation Society. They've got a dictionary of electronic terms used with reference to antennas. In that dictionary, they define gain as that property you measure of an antenna after you have accomplished a perfect impedance match. In other words, impedance match and standing wave ratio is not part of the gain phenomenon. Efficiency, you could say, really is the average gain. In other words, if I take an antenna, realize that it's going to radiate some amount of power into every single direction in three-dimensional space, and if I took my sphere, which happens to be a globe of the Earth, and I divided it up into one little bitty square, a whole bunch of little squares that are each 1 degree wide and 1 degree high. It's a difficult thing to do, particularly near the North Pole and the South Pole. Your squares would become triangles, if you know what I mean, but mathematically, you can do it. And if you did do that, the surprising thing is that the square of the 1 degree squares, or little chunks of area that are each 1 degree horizontal and vertical equivalent, that amount of area in angular space, with 41,253 1 degree squares on the surface of any real smooth sphere. So if I take my antenna with real good instrumentation, and I measure the power output in gain, let's call it gain, in every one of those 1 degree squares. In the case of the bore side of the antenna, where the antenna is aimed, I'm going to get some real potent power. In the case of the side lobes, nulls between the side lobes and the back lobes, I'm going to get very little power. But I'm a scientist, I'm going to add up every one of those little pieces of power. I add it all up. I knew I put 1 watt into the antenna, and I add up all those little squares, and I get half a watt. By definition, that antenna has got 50% efficiency. Assuming now that I've got a perfect impedance match, I put 1 watt into it, and the antenna radiated a tub repeater.
Time out.
The antenna radiated a total of half a watt into three-dimensional space when I add up all the power in all the directions. And I've accounted for reflected power. Say, for instance, the antenna also happened to have a real high standing wave ratio. And I'm going to pick a number out of the air. I think something like a 4-to-1 or 5-to-1 standing wave ratio means half the power is reflected. In other words, I've got a 50-ohm signal generator. I put 1 watt into the antenna. My standing wave ratio instrumentation told me that half a watt is coming back. And if, assuming I've accounted for the insertion loss of the transmission line, let me change the numbers. Let's assume now that I'm putting 2 watts into the antenna and 1 watt came back. And therefore, I know that 1 watt got radiated. So I've accounted for standing wave ratio. I'm too lazy to compensate for the standing wave ratio. I should really correct it at the antenna, but I'm going to account for it in other ways. I'm putting 2 watts out of the transmitter, and because of reflected power due to standing wave ratio, 1 watt's being radiated, and I did a real antenna gain measurement in a perfect anechoic chamber, and I see only half a watt is being radiated. By definition, that antenna that I just described has real VISWAR, and it's got real efficiency numbers that are less than ideal. At first, an awful lot of people will take exception to all that I've said by saying that, reflective power is part of the inefficiency. You put 2 watts in and only half a watt got radiated, therefore the antenna's got 25% efficiency. Oh, that's not fair, because they're lumping standing wave ratio into the gain performance measurement. A lot of other people don't realize that every real antenna, when you add up all the power in all directions, must add up to an equivalent isotropic. In other words, as if you're equally radiating the power in all directions, even though the antenna really favors certain directions. Gain, efficiency, directivity, standing wave ratio, reflective power, all these things are often misunderstood. The bottom line of all this is that it is quite difficult to measure, sit in the shack, measure standing wave ratio, and make an assumption about what the efficiency of the antenna is. Very difficult to do that. So you could almost say, with rare exception, standing wave ratio and efficiency are unrelated, completely separate parameters. And in that example of a 50% efficiency antenna that I just described, a modern-day
repeater, timeout,
a modern-day eclectic, objective, serious scientific engineer will deploy for the first time in his life a thermal imaging camera. Very little use of those have been made by antenna engineers in the past. With great difficulty at the place where I work, we managed to buy this expensive instrument, a thermal imaging camera, something that can resolve things at different temperatures photographically. It can see 1 degree Kelvin or maybe half a degree Kelvin of difference. You put 1 watt of power into that antenna. You aim a thermal imaging camera at it. Something is going to get hot, and it's going to blaze. It's going to show as a bright spot somewhere on your thermal imaging camera. The only way any real antenna can have inefficiency is it's taking some of your valuable RF power and turning it into heat. That's the only way. Of the power you put into an antenna from the transmission line, the antenna can only do 3 things with that power. Reflect some of it back to the transmitter, you can measure that. Radiate some of that into space, you can measure that. Turn some of it into heat. If you're a modern day engineer with a thermal imaging camera and you really use it, you can measure the amount of heat. You'll find out what's hot. You'll say, hey, that happens to be a high loss capacitor as part of the antenna, or the right hand side of the dipole. I thought I made a good solder joint and I got a cold solder joint, and it's demonstrating heat. A guy without a thermal imaging camera can put a number of watts of power into the antenna, do it for 5 minutes, turn off the transmitter, run over there real fast, and touch everything. Your hand will real fast show you what is hot. A couple of degrees Fahrenheit rise in the temperature of something that's inefficient in your antenna will show up as heat, and your hand will indicate that to you. So once you understand the laws of physics, the conservation of energy, and what's going on, and what an antenna can do with the power you put into it, there's ways of finding out who is eating your lunch and whether or not you're willing to make the investment to improve the situation. I know it's a little bit off to one side of what you asked, but maybe some of this helped a little bit, Joe. So the A2RYY, K2RIW on the TechNet.
Okay, maybe I should have given you the details first instead of you going that way, that direction. All right. Okay, let me put it to you this way for you. In an application where a radio link system is used to a repeater site, it's running about 20 watts at the transmitting end of the piece of cable, which is about 30, 40 feet long. The exact length doesn't matter, okay? Sweeping that antenna system from the transmitter end, looking into the cable and the beam antenna, which is pointed at the repeater, it had a return loss that varied from 1.96 to 2.84. That's what the instrumentation indicated. Sweep it from 420 to 450. So it seemed like nowhere in that band it was resonant at all. The signal level coming out of that particular installation was noisier than a half-watt radio operating on the same frequency with a rubber ducky antenna at the same location. So that's how poor this system was being operated. Once I corrected the resonance of the antenna and got it to about minus 18 or so on the transmit frequency, the performance changed drastically with the point the thing was basically full quieting from point to point, okay? My question, what I'm trying to understand is, with that kind of high return loss, is it that part of the power is turned into heat, or is it just part of it being turned back into a reflective power and energy? Because it seemed like you can't account for the differential of going with 20 watts of power, it's going nowhere, and a half a watt radio with a portable radio produces a better signal into the link receiver at the far end than this installation did. It just doesn't seem to be something that you can like grab onto as far as understanding what's happening here. It seemed like a tremendous amount of power, far more than being reflected back or indicated being reflected back, is coming into play here. You understand what I'm saying now?
I understand some of it. You told me you first swept the beam and you saw a 1.9 to 2.84 standing wave ratio as you swept from 420 to 450, and you called it a beam. Then you said you readjusted it to minus 18. You didn't give that any units. I presume that's minus 18 decibels of reflection coefficient. Is that true, Joe?
First of all, I didn't say VS to the R. I measured everything in return loss. The particular instrument is set to measure things in return loss. It had a return loss of minus 1.96, worst case, to the best case, minus 2.84, best case, between 420 and 450 megahertz. Essentially, it looked like all the power you put in, most of it was being reflected back to the transmitter source.
Okay, so the 1.96 to 2.84 was not standing wave ratio. That was reflected power in watts. Then when you retuned it, you got minus 18. What does minus 18 mean?
We're still talking on the different pages here. I did not say the term wattage at all. You said that. The highest level I recorded was minus 1.96, and the best case was minus 2.84 in dB. dB return loss.
Wow. 1.96 dB of return loss. Does that mean the forward going power and the reverse power were only 1.96? Let me round it off to 2 dB. Are you saying the forward going power and the reverse measured power in the beginning were only 2 dB apart? Is that what you're saying, Joe? Go ahead.
That's less than a decimal apart, actually, to the numbers I gave you. What, minus 1.96 to minus 2.84. Those are the two readings as far as minimum and maximum return loss on the antenna circuit, measured between 420 and 450 megahertz.
Hey, you're going to get angry at me, Joe, but I've got to understand what you're saying, because you've given me a number of ambiguities here. To me, minus 1.96 and minus 2.84, you've said multiple times that represents decibels. Decibels are a ratio. I want to know, what's a ratio of what? Is it a ratio of forward power versus reverse power? What is that a ratio of, Joe? Go ahead.
I thought you would understand what I'm talking about directly, because I use the instrumentation I use specifically, I have it set up to give you dB return loss. If I had a minus 20 decibel reading as far as return loss compared to the forward power, that would be 1%. Minus 10 would be 10%. So minus 1.96 has got to be pretty bad as far as reflective power. That's the point I'm trying to get at here. I'm using a Sightmaster, and RIT2 Sightmaster. That's what it's set up to read. It's not set up to read VSWR. It's set up to read return loss in decibels.
That's voltage reflection coefficient there.
That's what I thought. S11. Okay, so the minus 1.96 to minus 2.84 is decibels of voltage reflection coefficient through 30 or 40 feet of cable of that antenna. And that's the antenna that worked poorly. Wow. That antenna better work poorly. To me, 1.96 to 2.84 are reflection coefficient. A reflection coefficient of minus 20 is fantastic. A reflection coefficient of 1 or 2 dB is terrible. So a terrible reflection coefficient was an antenna that performed poorly. Where's there a surprise here, Joe? What am I missing? Go ahead.
Well, what I should have done was swept the antenna from, say, 350 megahertz up to 500 to actually find out the resonant point. It was resonant someplace in the UHF spectrum. I just didn't bother to specifically find out exactly where because I wasn't concerned about it. I wanted to see if it operated within the band of its intent, and it was operating extremely poorly. All right, so taking those numbers like I'm talking about, -1.96 to -2.84, you talk about a percentage. I don't know how you know how to calculate it better than I do. You talk about, what, 40% reflective power approximately of those kind of ratios, maybe 50%?
More like 85%.
Exactly. It's huge. If I include the insertion loss of your 30 or 40 feet of cable, those numbers for reflection might represent the two-way insertion loss of the transmission line, which implies that the antenna is radiating nothing. It's acting almost like a dead short circuit. The fact that you didn't sweep it far enough to find where the resonance was is academic. If you're trying to use it at 448 megacycles, for instance, and it happens to be resonant at 530 megacycles, that's nice, but at 448 megs, that doesn't do you any good. The performance of the antenna at 448 is what counts. You're giving me numbers showing me that the antenna is either a dead short circuit or an open circuit, but it isn't accepting any power. Those numbers of decibels sound to me like the insertion loss of your cable. So the antenna is accepting none of the power. Therefore, by conservation of energy, it can't radiate very much of the power. And that antenna performed poorly compared to a rubber duck. To me, that all hangs together. I'm a little bit not quite understanding what is the surprise. Over to you, Joe.
It's not that it's a surprise. I'm trying to understand if that had, say, like 85 or, say, 90% reflection, if it even had that. Well, it's hard to really actually prove if the antenna was radiating any energy whatsoever. I didn't want to do it with a field strength meter check that. I did check it with a mobile operation about a half a mile away from the particular location. The signal reception was extremely poor. And I can understand why the site at 5.4 miles away was not hearing the particular signal, very quieting at all. And like I said, a half a watt, an HD running a half a watt on the same frequency of a rubber duck at ground level, and this antenna is about 15, maybe 18 feet above the ground, something like that, was producing a weaker signal than the HD at ground level was producing on the same frequency.
Okay, you don't have to make a field strength measurement. You know that beam antenna, you called it, I'm going to call it a Yagi, but a beam antenna, was aimed in the right direction. You wouldn't bother aiming it in the wrong direction. You know that it performed poorly, obvious by the fact that the communication, maybe this, for instance, was a link to a repeater, and it wasn't working well. It was noisy by comparison to a rubber duck. 2 dB of loss implies that 63% of the power is going to the right place, and 37% is being reflected. That's what 2 dB reflection coefficient is. However, if your transmission line has approximately 1 dB of loss for its 30 or 40 feet at 450 megacycles, then it very well could have. If your transmission line has got 1 or 2 dB of loss, and you're measuring 2 dB reflection coefficient, it implies that all the loss you're seeing is the transmission line, as if the far end of the transmission line is a perfect short or an open. So a mistuned antenna that represents an extremely poor impedance to a transmission line will mean that the transmission line delivers very little of its power to that poor impedance. Most of it gets reflected. You measured that. So once we understand what's going on, it sounds to me like it all hangs together. What's your best guess as to the insertion loss of that cable, Joe? You probably know it in decibels of dB per 100 feet. You know you've got 30 or 40 feet of it, and we can work it out that way. So B2RYY, K2RYW.
Cable is LMR 400. I do not recall a specific loss at 450 megahertz per 100 feet, what the loss is in decibels as far as loss, but it can't be that terribly high.
I'm going to guess it's around 3 or so dB per 100 feet, 3.5. That means you've got a third of 100 feet. You've got very close to a decibel of loss in the cable. You measure 2 dB of return loss, which means the signal has been up and back. It looks to me like almost all of the loss you measured when you measured the 1.96, almost every bit of it, is cable loss. That implies the antenna was almost a perfect short circuit, Joe. I am curious, when you retuned the antenna and you got a reflection coefficient of minus 18, which used to be minus 2, what did you have to do to retune the antenna, Joe? Go ahead.
Okay, Dick, this antenna is a Cushcraft multi-element beam that's intended to be used in the 440 to 450 normal amateur beam. It was running about maybe 8, 10 megahertz below that. And I have the sweeper between 420 to 450 just to see if I could find it, how far out of band it was. It was apparently way, way out of band. So what you're saying makes a lot of sense, that the reaction return loss of the antenna by itself was so high that it was reflected, just virtually all the power going into it was being reflected, completely returned back to the transmitter source. So that starts to make some sense now, because comparing it to an HT, it was quite a difference in signal level. And once I corrected the problem, it was quite a bit the other way. What I did was take a piece of aluminum and put it on the bottom of the reflector, not the driven side, the reflector side of the dipole, that end, and just to increase the mass. And that lowered the resonance of the antenna, and then by playing with the gamma match, I was able to get the thing to operate at the correct operating transmit frequency, where it indicated about minus 18 dB return loss at the transmit frequency.
Okay, you put some aluminum on the reflector end. I'm not quite sure what that means. How many element Yagi was this? Did you retune driven element, retune reflector? What did you retune, Joe?
Okay, on the driven element, on the side that's not the gamma mesh, I guess you call it theoretically the cold side, for lack of a better term. Not the gamma mesh side, but the other side. Yeah, that's the side I put a piece of aluminum about 2 inches length piece of tubing and put it just about even with the end of the element, just to add some mass to the end of the element. That lowered the resonance of that particular element drastically. Because when I took it off, the dip flattened out quite a bit, but it also broadened out quite a bit. So with that piece of metal there, it gave me a nice dip, relatively nice dip, and as I adjusted with the gamma match to get it to be about minus 18 or so on the desired transmit frequency. Trying the same thing to add it on the driven side, the hot side of the driven element, it did not help at all. It actually made things quite worse.
That's a little strange, but I'm gonna believe what you said. Joe, have you ever had a chance to read this Yagi tuning article that I wrote? That's in the WA1MDA website, Whiskey Alpha 1, MikeBravoAlpha.com. On the bottom of that, there's some K2LIW Yagi tuning information. Wonder if you've ever had a chance to see that particular article, Joe. Go ahead.
The answer to that would be no.
Okay. I do recommend you look at that. It's going to help. Because what you did is one of the recommended steps, and there are other recommended steps there that'll help you both get this antenna right and to understand what's going on. It turns out that the driven element of any Yagi you have ever seen, or any dipole you've ever seen, or any monopole you've ever seen, at whatever frequency you desire, can be forced into a perfect 50 ohm resistive match with no reactants by following the procedure of that article. I've tried to have that article published in the United States, and everybody turns it down. It's been published in England, Australia, and New Zealand, and they love it. The United States thinks it's boring. They think everybody knows how to tune a dipole. And obvious by what I'm hearing, both on the TechNet for the last 1982, 27 years. This coming September, it'll be 27 years. The majority of people only partially understand what they're doing when they tune a Yagi. I tune a dipole, no matter where the dipole is. It can be part of a Yagi or a dipole in free space. The secret that's been kept away from them all these years is that you can force the resistive component to always be 50.0 ohms, if that's what you want, or 70.0 ohms, if you happen to be using 70 ohm cable, by doing nothing but adjusting the length. And I'm talking about electrical length. You can physically adjust the length by putting telescoping pieces of tubing out there, if you like, or you can put top hat capacitors with pieces of tinfoil, if you like, or pieces of copper tape. And you tune them by bending the copper tape so that it presents more area or less area to the air, or more length or less length. The article explains that. once you get the resistive component exactly where you want, quite often there's a reactive component left over, and there's a very, very simple procedure indicated in that article that'll tell you how to make the reactive component go to zero. Once the antenna is 50.0 ohms resistive and 0 ohms reactive, it is a perfect dummy load as far as the transmission line is concerned. 99.9% of your power going down the transmission line that arrives at the antenna will be accepted by the antenna, and none of it will be reflected back. That's a very desirable condition. It's extremely easy to find by following that procedure, by going to the website of...
Repeater, timeout.
By going to the website of Whiskey Alpha 1, MikeBravoAlpha.org. I'll repeat that. Whiskey Alpha 1, MikeBravoAlpha.org. And then at the bottom of that webpage on his so-called microwave reflector site, at the bottom of that page, you'll find the Yagi tuning information by K2RIW. You click on that section and look at those two graphs and read that article, and you'll read about a couple thousand words that explains all this. It's been there for quite a few years. Of the people who have found it, they said, wow, why has this been kept a secret from me all these years? It's a very valuable piece of information. I'm a little bit perplexed by the fact that when you tuned your driven element, and there is no reflector side, the driven element has a hot side and a cold side. You're absolutely right on that one. In the case of the Kushcraft gamma match, the side that you're feeding with the gamma match rod, you could call it the hot side. It's exactly right. And the fact that one side acted differently than the other is a bit mysterious, but quite possibly what was happening is one side, when you added your aluminum, it created more reactants as well as tuning the resistive component. It did that more than on one side than the other. No matter how you did it, as long as you forced the driven element to be a dipole-like structure that presents a good impedance match to your transmission line, you do that, and now you've done everything as far as you can to the driven element. Assuming that Kushcraft has done its job, and assuming that the rest of the parasitic elements are the right electrical length and the right position in three-dimensional space, then the antenna has got to fly. See if I got any further questions or comments or fills you might need on any of that, Joe. WA2RYY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Well, let me tell you how the gamma match tuned on this particular installation here. The gamma match, if you're familiar with how they work, the tuning, I guess you'd call it the tuning strap, was all at the end of the gamma match, as far away from the boom as possible, and it even could go further, but the piece of metal wasn't long enough. But the entire gamma match was pushed close to the boom as much as possible. In other words, it had as much capacitive coupling between the gamma match center and the outside antenna, the outside two-piece of tubing. That was coupled as much as possible, and the strap was as far within the boom as possible. That generated the best return loss figure at the desired transmit frequency, which was operating approximately 433 megahertz. That's the best they go. It seemed like that tube had to be actually physically longer for me to get a better match at the exact precise frequency I was looking for, but since I didn't have that available, I couldn't do that.
You just said 433 megacycles, and I'm a bit confused by that. Was this a 432 Yagi that you decided to move to 449, or vice versa? Even when you make the driven element a perfect impedance match in order to get full performance out of the antenna, you would like the rest of the parasitic elements to be tuned to your particular frequency, which maybe is 448, because you did say it was a 450 antenna as part of a link, but maybe your link is on 433. So worry that, about that a little bit. What was the original frequency of the antenna? Where did you move it from to, Joe? Go ahead.
Original operating frequency is 433. I told you I swept the antenna from 420 to 450 just to find out if it was resonant anywhere in that entire range, which it was initially was not. Because this had the, I told this guy previously to take a piece of aluminum and take about a 2-inch piece of aluminum and put it on the top of the driven element and the bottom of the driven element. And that would help lower the resonant frequency, because I've done that before on another beam I used in another installation, and it worked. It helped lower the resonant frequency. I know it's not going to make the rest of the antenna resonant or operate completely in the desired frequency. There's nothing I could do about that. I'd have to make all the elements longer.
to make everything fall in line accordingly. That wasn't just, I just didn't have enough time to do that. The antenna seems to work. It seems to develop some sort of gain. It is radiating. It is working at the particular installation right now, so I have solved the problem. My initial question was, and you answered it by telling me that the apparent return loss of the cable was probably about maybe 80% of what I was actually measuring, maybe more. So it seemed like the antenna was radiating actually maybe 2%, 1% of power was actually being radiated by the antenna itself. You answered my question.
Okay, glad about that. What was the original frequency of the antenna? What is the frequency you would like to use it on? Back to you, Joe. When I say original frequency, it was designed for what frequency according to the Cushgraf spec, and you desire to use it on what frequency? Go ahead.
As far as the operation of the antenna, what it's designed for, it's probably designed to be a 440 to 450 antenna. It's a how many elements the antenna is made by Cushgraf. I don't know if it's 11 elements or how many elements is the, I think it's the exact number of elements. It's a little longer than what I'm accustomed to using myself. The standard Cushgraf multi-element type of beam. The desired operating frequency was approximately 433 megahertz. That was the uplink frequency.
Okay, so you want to use it on 433, and it was designed for 440 to 450. That's the desirable direction. Most Yagis, as you take a Yagi of a particular design, and then you decide to use it as a lower frequency, the gain falls off in a fairly controlled manner. If you did the opposite, if it was a 432 antenna and you wanted to use it on 450, the gain can fall off like a cliff. As you start going up in frequency from the design, it can fall off very fast. When you go down in frequency, it falls off very slow. So most likely the rest of the Yagi is giving you a good percentage of the performance you'd like to get. But a necessary but not sufficient condition is the driven element's got to give you a good match. And now that you have the greater knowledge, a person with a whole lot of experience would have said a 2 dB reflection coefficient, wow, I'm alarmed. That is an alarming measurement, a 2 dB reflection coefficient after 30 or 40 feet of cable. That means the antenna is almost a dead short circuit. And a driven element that is tuned to some other frequency will do that, almost act like a dead short circuit at that particular frequency. In the case of the gamma rod, you can adjust the gamma rod length. That means the end clip where it connects between the gamma rod and the dipole itself, and also and many of them is a variable capacitor. The gamma rod has got a series capacitor on the gamma rod itself and a clip on the end where you can decide how long is the gamma rod. And when you talk about the upper half and the lower half of the dipole and you extended both of them with metal, I guess you're talking about the hot side and the cold side. That's one interpretation. Another interpretation is that you're extending the length of the dipole section and you're extending the length of the gamma rod section. I don't think you meant that. Let's see if I made some correct guesses on any of those, Joe. W-H-U-R-Y-Y, K-Q-R-I-W.
No, I previously have not had to extend the gamma length, the gamma rod length of a particular antenna. I was using one made by Sinclair. It wasn't made by Cushgraf, but I had a similar construction, SO239 for a connector. I didn't have to do that. With this particular antenna of this design, it seemed like the gamma match would have had to be a little longer by about a half an inch or so to get the antenna to be really nice and resonant on the desired resonance frequency exactly. It didn't quite make it there. It was actually I was actually had better resonance on a higher frequency of about 434.3 is about minus 20. So at the desired operating frequency of 433 and change, it was about minus 18. So it wasn't like dead on as far as what it could be. Couldn't get it to go any better than that. But it doesn't matter because the guy's running it now. He's not burning his transmitter up. He's not having issues, and he has a nice signal between his house and the repeater site. So I did accomplish what I intended to accomplish for him by helping him get his link operating properly.
Sounds good. Let us know any further tests and measurements you make on that system, Joe. It sounds like you made it fly. And now that we understand the readings, what was happening in the beginning became a little bit more clear. Paul, WS2N, I think you said you've got something to tell us about what Endeavor is doing. WS2N, if you were there, H-U-R-I-W in the TechNet.
I think I wanted to make some comments about RL.
Okay, let Mel go then. I'll be here, Dick.
Roger, you got it, Mel.
Hey. I have worked a number of times with return loss. In fact, I built a very nice little return loss bridge at one time, which I found very handy because it does go through a really wide range of use. And there was a formula that was published in one of the books. I don't remember which one of the books that got published. I don't remember if it was the IEEE procedures or one of Maxwell's. I think it was possibly Maxwell. And he had a formula called RL at the antenna is equal to RL at the transmitter, all dBs, of course, minus 2 times, it was RL at the antenna equals RL the transmitter minus 2 times L loss at the coax in dBs. Have you ever worked with that, over?
You could say I work with it every day, Mel. Once you realize that return loss means that some amount of power you're sending up the transmission line does not get accepted by the antenna and reflects back toward the transmitter. And the only way you can get all the way back to the transmitter is it's been through the transmission line twice. And forward-going power and reverse-coming power experience the exact same number of decibels of loss of the cable. If your cable, for instance, had 1 dB of loss because it is 30 feet long at 450 megacycles, a good piece of hard line, 1 dB of loss means that if you put a perfect short circuit or a perfect open circuit at the far end, your power would be 1 dB weaker on the way up. It hits the short circuit, all of it reflects. It'll have another dB of loss coming back. Therefore, you will experience the insertion loss of the cable twice in decibels. And it would be 2 dB of loss. So I agree with that formula exactly. So return loss measured at the antenna equals return loss seen in the shack minus twice the loss of the cable. You've got to be careful with the minuses and pluses here because return loss often is measured as a negative number and insertion loss of the cable is a negative number. But now you're going to put a minus in front of it. Some people will have two minuses become a positive and they'll get it backwards. When in doubt, use the insertion loss of the cable to make the reading in the shack look worse, which means a stronger amount of signal. Do whatever you've got to do with the insertion loss of the cable. Take the insertion loss of the cable, double it, and then combine it by subtraction or addition, depending on how you do it mathematically, so that the resultant loss measured in the shack gets worse. That means at the antenna it really was worse. See, if your transmission line had a whole lot of loss, if I had a transmission line with 10 dB of loss, my antenna could really be yucky, almost a dead short circuit. I'd have 10 dB of loss of the signal going up, 10 dB of loss of the signal coming back. In the shack, I'd measure a return loss of minus 20 dB if the antenna was real terrible. A naive person would say, gee, minus 20 dB reflection coefficient, that's roughly a 1.15 ISWR, that's a great antenna. Dead wrong. So I 100% agree with what you're saying, Mel. I've used it often, and just the mathematics of adding and subtracting negative dB, sometimes
repeater, timeout.
The mathematical process of adding and subtracting negative dBs sometimes gets a little bit spooky. K2KEY, K2LIW.
Okay, you know, let me expand on this a little bit because I know we're going to get questions galore. I think we may have lost some people in our audience. What I have just brought up is a very interesting concept that Vic was trying to, explain it more in depth. And I think the best thing is to give an example of a measurement I made. I had a measurement I'm making with my return loss bridge at the transmitter. Right at the transmitter where you would normally plug the cable into the back of the transmitter, I made a measurement of a 2:1. Okay? That's my SWR measurement. Now I decide to use the return loss bridge and see what happens if how I can convert this into dB. Actually, the cable I was using has a return loss, measured return loss of 1.75 dB. The coax loss, we'll just put the coax loss as 1.75 dB as I measured.
So putting this into the formula, a 2-to-1 SWR converted into dB, RL, return loss to dB, would be 9.5 dB, minus 2 times the coax loss, which again I said was 1.75 dB measured, would now equal, so 2 times 1.75 times 1.75 2 times, in other words, 1.75, we're going to multiply it by 2, and then we're going to subtract that from the 9.5 dB that we converted the 2-to-1 SWR into. And that means that we have essentially a 6 dB return loss. I think that is maybe a little clearer, Dick. Over.
It sure is. And a 6 dB return loss instead of the 9.5 dB raw reading that you measured means that what you thought was a 2-to-1 VISWR, I don't know what the exact number, but a 6 dB return loss is probably something like a 3-to-1 standing wave ratio really at the antenna. So that mathematical example makes it clearer.
Yeah.
It turns out that people will rate the loss of a cable. My cable's got a dB of loss. Well, some people will go one step more exact and say it's minus 1 dB of insertion loss. Is loss measured in positive or negative dBs? Oh, half the world is on each one on that one. So the word subtract, the dBs doubled, becomes a little spooky. I like your example. So 9 dB of reflection coefficient, 1.75 dB of cable, used type twice, becomes 3.5. 9.5, 3.5, subtract one from the other, 6.0 is the resultant return loss. Now calculated for what it would have been had you made the measurement at the other end of the feed line at the antenna 40 feet in the air. It's a good example. I like it. And an awful lot of people know that standing wave ratio is undesirable. They'd like it to be as low as possible. The conversion of standing wave ratio into decibels of reflection coefficient. There's usually a nomograph or a graph in either the ARO antenna book or the amateur radio's handbook, which makes that clearer. And if need be, I can give you a formula for that. Although people are a little bit reluctant to use formulas. It scares them. They'd much rather look it up as a graph. Do you do it as a formula, or do you usually look it up as a graph, Mel? K2KEY, K2RIW.
Well, usually what is convenient for me most of the time is use a formula, because I have them all, you know, in the calculator that I use at one time or another. Everything, you know, is convenient. Now, as Vic said, when we now, when I measured this 6 dB of return loss, 6 dB basically now will convert to a actual, as he said, a 3-to-1 SWR. Now, suppose I just give you one other example. You can do it another way and show you that the flexibility of return loss is how much more accurate. If you want to know actually, let's say, the SWR at your transmitter, and your antenna, let's say, has an SWR measured at the antenna, we have an SWR, say, of 1.5, and as Vic said, we have a coax with a 1 dB measured loss. We can now take this formula and work it around the same way, and we can look up, and if we have at the antenna a 1.5 dB, a 1.5 SWR measured at the antenna, that would convert to 14 dB of RL, of return loss. So putting that in, we have 14 dB of return loss plus, in this case, plus 2 times the 1 dB loss, the coax loss. If we put that together, we have, we'll show that we now have a return loss of 16 dB. In other words, 14 dB plus 2. And we have 16 dB. Now, if we look up, or we convert 16 dB of return loss, we actually will have now an SWR somewhere in the neighborhood of about 1.35, and that very close to 1.35, that'll be the actual SWR
now at the transmitter, going the other way around. I hope that's clear, over.
It sure is. So whatever the standing wave ratio is at the antenna, in the shack, because of the insertion loss of the cable, it will almost always be better. The antenna of 1.5, real, because of the insertion loss of the cable, will look like a 1.35 in the shack. I'm going to give you the formula. If you know the standing wave ratio, and we're going to call it S, the 1.5, the 2.0, the 2.5 standing wave ratio, we're going to call it S. The formula is S minus 1 divided by S plus 1. Take the log of that and multiply by 20. So to start from the very beginning, standing wave ratio, correction, reflection coefficient equals 20 times LOG of S minus 1 in the denominator divided by S plus 1 in the numerator. So in the case of a 2 to 1 standing wave ratio, as an example, 2 to 1 standing wave ratio, S is equal to 2. In the numerator, I take 2 minus 1, I end up with 1. In the denominator, I take S plus 1, which is 2 plus 1, 3. I divide the denominator into the numerator. I'm dividing 3 into 1. I take the log of that. If I take the log of 1/3 and multiply it by 20, I end up with 9.5 decibels, and it will be negative decibels. So a 2 to 1 VSWR is a fancy way of saying that of the power that you're sending to that device with a 2 to 1 VSWR, it will reflect 9.5 dB of it, roughly 10%, just a skosh more than 10%. Minus 10 dB would be a 10% power reflection. And the reason why you're multiplying by 20 when you take the log is that the calculation for reflection is a voltage calculation, believe it or not, and to convert the voltage ratios into decibels, you have to take 20 times the log instead of 10 times the log. Somebody might ask that question. I wonder if you want to make that formula simpler than all I just did, Mel. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Yeah, for most people, the easiest way is to look up the return loss and SWR table. I think it's in Maxwell's Another Look at Reflection. For some reason, that stands out in my mind. And he converts there. He will show you how he converts directly. He has it all in starting at with an SWR of 1.00, going all the way up to 39.00. Then, of course, we're forced to pass that. Forget about it. So he's going in steps, very small steps there, of 10, I believe, or something like that, if I remember correctly. There is a nice chart how he goes from 1.00, 1.10, 1.2, etc., going up that way. And also, in the chart, you'll see something else. It says P, and then in a parenthesis, V. That is the reflection. It also, the SWR is now also converted into what is known as reflection coefficient. But maybe we should stay away from that at this point, Dick. Over.
There's sort of a yes and a no to that. If a person has access to a vector network analyzer, the parameter it measures is called voltage reflection coefficient, and they represent that as S subscript 1-1. The average person will call it S-1-1. S-1-1 means that I'm applying a power to port number 1 of my device, and I'm looking at the reflection of port number 1. That's why there's a double 1 there. Whereas if I'm taking a black box that's got an input connector and an output connector, and I want to measure the gain, I measure S21. The reason they call it S21 is that's the voltage forward transfer characteristic. 2 means I'm taking the power out of port number 2 after putting in the power to port number 1. That's what S21 means. out. The first subscript is telling you what is the output connector. The second subscript is telling you what is the input connector. And to a vector network analyzer, all reflections, all gains are measured as voltage ratios. And then you can convert those into decibels if you like by taking 20 times the log of them. So it turns out that standing wave ratio is something you measure on a slotted line. Almost no, or lecture wires. Almost nobody uses lecture wires since 1930. Almost nobody uses a slotted line since around 1980, because we now use, let me drop, we now use either a directional coupler mechanism, like a Bird wattmeter. It measures forward power and reverse power. That's a directional coupler mechanism. Or we use a directional coupler, which has a certain coupling coefficient that tells you how much power is going forward, how much power is going reverse. So real measurement of impedance mismatch today is measured as ratio of forward and reverse power, or ratio of forward and reverse voltage. Use whichever units you like or whichever measurement procedure you like. Almost nobody uses a slotted line or lecture wires. Therefore, we do not directly measure standing wave ratio anymore. We measure the real thing that's happening. The slotted line was telling you, okay, a certain amount of power is going forward, a certain amount of power is coming back, and you take the carriage and the probe on the slotted line, and you move it to the point where both of those voltages are in phase. You call that the peak. You move it to another place, a quarter wave away, where there's a valley, where they're out of phase with each other, and you look at the ratio of peak to valley, and we called it standing wave ratio. For the slotted line, you directly made the measurement. We don't do that anymore. And then you went and calculated what was the ratio of forward power and reverse power. Nowadays, we directly measure forward power and reverse power. So it's time we get used to voltage reflection coefficient or power reflection coefficient, whichever you like. That's the real measurement today. It's only for traditional reasons we keep calling it standing wave ratio. Today, the word standing wave ratio is the coded message. It's not the direct measurement anymore. You really want to know what percentage of the power is staying there and what percentage of the power is coming back. We now directly measure it, and this wire is an indirect measurement. But that's a philosophy. Not everyone agrees with that philosophy. I've said it for some time. Okay, I think we've spent enough time on standing wave ratio for now. It's a subject that is probably one of the most discussed subjects in all of ham radio. Antennas and standing wave ratio and transmission line characteristics. Mel and I have been at this now by way of the TechNet for me, 27 years, and for Mel most of that time, and we will be discussing it if we stay in good health. 1, 2, 5, 10 years from now, we will still be discussing standing
repeater. Time out. Let me say one final word on this, Dick, before the confusion starts.
Go ahead, Mel.
Okay. What Dick just brought up, he started to bring in something else that possibly may compare the use of spectrum analyzers and things like that. A return loss bridge. When we're talking about a return loss bridge, as we were just discussing, to measure RL, the output is in RF. So a compatible instrument, as Dick just brought up, such as a spectrum analyzer or what is known as log detection, so that when you look at a spectrum analyzer, the display on a spectrum analyzer, for example, is usually based on what we call DBM. I know I've had a couple of questions, that's why I'm elaborating on this. DBM. Now, what do we mean by DBM? Let me explain that really quickly. That is dB relative to 1 milliwatt. So then, that means that on a spectrum analyzer, the scale, therefore, is in decibels. So the output of an RL bridge that we're talking about here, a return loss bridge, can therefore be viewed directly, if we wanted to, as I would do it, on a spectrum analyzer on the log dB scale. Basically, there is the connection, as Dick was bringing up Dick. I think because people are going to, again, ask me, what is this DBM business? So I think there's the best example of DBM. Over.
I like that. And we amateurs, because we are trying to be scientists, and we like to make measurements of our antennas, the antenna gain, the insertion loss of a particular path, propagation loss, reflection from the antenna to any wave ratio. The vast majority of radio measurements are measured in decibels of some kind. DBM is one of the most popular, dB with reference to 1 milliwatt. There's also dBW, dB with reference to a watt, dBW. If you're in the cable television business, dBmV is the most popular unit. dB with reference to a microvolt. You present a microvolt to a good television receiver, and it gives you a certain response. And dB with reference to that microvolt, if your particular cable company is giving you a signal level of plus 20 dBmV, plus 20 dB with reference to a microvolt, and I hope it's not millivolts, dBmV, I think it's microvolts, not millivolts, I could be corrected on that, but you can see whichever one of the references are. So there's lots of kinds of decibels. Decibels with reference to milliwatt, watt, millivolt, microvolt, dBV, and there are other kinds of dB, but all decibel measurements are a ratio with reference to something, forward versus reverse, reverse versus a milliwatt, reverse versus a watt, reverse versus a millivolt or a microvolt, and so on. Learning decibels is a very valuable thing. And why are decibels valuable? Let me drop. Decibels are something where you take the logarithm of something. Every $10 calculator has a button you press after you put a number on the screen, and it'll take the log of that number, the logarithm of that number. Or you can look it up in good mathematical books. If the number is 10, the logarithm is 1. If the number is 100, the logarithm is 2. If the number is 1,000, the logarithm is 3. You could say that the logarithm is the number of zeros you put after the 1 in order to make the logarithm. The logarithm of 10,000 would be 4. The logarithm of a million would be 6. Because the number million has got 6 zeros. The logarithm of a million is 6. The advantage of logs is that huge ratios of something, power or voltage, becomes a nice small number that's easy to handle. If, for instance, I've got two amplifiers as a preamplifier in front of my receiver, and the first preamplifier has a gain of 10 dB, and the second preamplifier has a gain of 20 dB, that really means that the power going into the first amplifier with 10 dB of gain comes out 10 to 1 larger. The second amplifier with a gain of 20 dB, the power versus going in, coming out, is 100 to 1 ratio. 20 dB is 100 to 1 ratio. The two amplifiers combined, 10 to 1 gain on the first, 100 to 1 gain on the second, is a total of 1,000 to 1 gain. 1,000 to 1 gain is 30 dB. With decibels, you do that all directly. My first amplifier has got 10 dB of gain. My second amplifier has got 20 dB of gain. Put them together, I got 30 dB of gain. You just add the numbers. So things that normally multiply, power, improvement of amplifiers that are cascaded, becomes a very simple addition of relatively small, easy-to-handle numbers when you do it in decibels. Let me give you a real good example. If I was sending a signal out of my antenna in the backyard, and I aim the antenna at the moon, and the antenna goes up to the moon, reflects off the moon, and comes back down, and I receive that signal. And if I was doing it on the 432 megacycle ham band, it is well documented. The propagation loss to the moon and back is 263 decibels. For me to write down 263 decibels of path loss is an easy number to write. I can now calculate, okay, my transmitting antenna has got 23 dB of gain. I'm going to use it for receiving. My receiving antenna has got 23 dB of gain. My transmitter has got a kilowatt of power. That's plus 60 dB with reference to a milliwatt. My receiver can receive a signal of minus 120 dB. I can add and subtract the decibels, and I can say, okay, I'm either going to make it when I do that moon bounce experiment, I'm going to hear my own echoes, or I'm not. I can add and subtract those numbers and figure it out. but let me go back and find out what would happen if I didn't use decibels. The path loss to the moon and back, let me drop, is on 432, 263 dB. That is a huge ratio of the power you transmit. Most of it gets smeared all over in the space, and a little bit hits the surface of the moon. Of the power that hits that yucky dirt on the surface of the moon, that regolith or whatever it's called, 7% of that power is reflected. Of the power that's reflected off the moon, it gets scattered all over into space, and a little bit of it comes back to the Earth, and a little bit of it finds my tiny little antenna in my backyard. The ratio of what I sent out versus what gets through all of that jazz and comes back to me is 263 dB. If I wrote it down as the real number in power out versus power back, it would be a number with 1 and 26 zeros after it. 263 dB is 26 zeros, and the number in front, the 1, would even be a smaller than that. I think it would be about 0.5 with 26 zeros. A huge number, hard to write. And that's just one factor. And for me to figure out what the transmit is doing, what the antenna is doing for transmit and receive and so on, it'd be very hairy mathematics. I would easily drop some of those zeros. I'd make errors up the kazoo. Once you decide to do it in decibels, it becomes fairly simple. These great big ratios become a nice small number, and you simply add and subtract. Those great big numbers, the one with the 26 zeros after it for the path loss, I'd have to be using that as a multiplication and division factor if I wasn't doing it with decibels. With decibels, it becomes small numbers that I add and subtract. Gives you a huge advantage. The receiver you're listening to me with right now, let me drop. It's hard for you to believe, but the receiver you're listening to my voice with right now, it's connected to an antenna, and from that antenna connector, it's going through a preamplifier, a mixer, an IF stage, a second conversion stage, a demodulator stage, an audio amplifier stage, and whatever. What comes out of the loudspeaker or the earphones that you're listening to right now has been through approximately 120 decibels of gain. The average receiver between the antenna port and your earphones or your loudspeaker has approximately 120 decibels of gain. That's one with 12 zeros after it. Huge ratio. There's a lot of stages in there, and they're busy as all hell processing that signal you're listening to. You take it for granted. With decibels, 120 dB, it's an easy number to write. To write down a number with 1 and 12 zeros after it, and that's one of the factors that I'm going to be multiplying and dividing if I was trying to figure out what the receiver was doing, and I wasn't using decibels, it would drive me up a wall, and it would make lots of mistakes. The bottom line of all this is that if you're going to be in the technical field, particularly wireless radio field, I strongly recommend, and Mel recommends, that you become familiar with decibels. They're a little bit crazy sounding at first. It's got a learning curve. It's not going to come easy. Study the graph, study the mathematics, whatever. Become familiar with them, because it is the vocabulary used in that technical field. If you can't speak in decibels, you will not be speaking the language. The majority of the people you communicate with will think you're speaking Chinese when you're trying to speak English. They live in the world of decibels. If you go to the website, let me drop. You go to the website called amateurradio.tv, www.amateurradio.tangovictor, and you look for the TechNet. You will see a separate section that Mike Perry has set aside, in which he has gathered together the lectures that Mel has given on the subject of decibels. You go to that website, you go to that subsection, you listen to what Mel had to say on decibels, and you'll learn two-thirds of what you got to know. And if you're going to work in the radio field, do learn to manipulate decibels. And the more skill you can demonstrate with decibels, the more money they will pay you. That's an opinion. Let's see what Mel can say on all that. K2KEY, K2RIW.
WX2N, one question.
K2JXM.
Okay, we heard Paul and JXM in that order, but Mel first. Go ahead, Mel.
Okay, this is K2KEY. Well, let me put it to you this way. Using dBs, and I'll tell you one of the greatest advantages Dick was just alluding to, but I'll tell you personally, I'll make it very simple what I'm going to say. For instance, I was bringing up here using a return loss bridge. I use the return loss bridge for making my measurements rather than the conventional reflectometer type of SWR meter. And the reason for that is, believe it or not, with the return loss bridge, I have one that it can go from 2 megahertz to, in other words, from around 160 meters to 2,000 megahertz, and the accuracy is exactly, it tracks exactly. Now, why? Because this thing is not based on using short couple pieces of transmission lines or these little transformers that they stick in the modern versions. So if you have something like a simple return loss bridge, now I'm talking about, well, mine is a commercial version, but let's talk about a simple version of it that you can even put together yourself. If you go ahead and use that, basically what you're using is a, what we remember, mentioned a number of times, what we call a hybrid combiner for signal generators. Basically, this is what you're working with. In fact, the dynamic receiver test that is made at the ARRL, they use a pair of signal generators for this dynamic signal, dynamic test, and they actually use a combiner, a return loss bridge. So, it shows you that once you get used, like Dick said, to use work with DB, you'll find there is in your accuracy, you can tell, you're not subject to all kinds of problems like when you use a conventional SWR bridge, and you'll notice, let me drop and I'll give you a good example. You'll notice that all the SWR bridges, if you make a measurement, let's say, let's just talk about HF, you make a measurement with it at 80 meters, and now, and it was to calibrate it up for 80 meters to make the measurement. If you now jump to 10 meters, you'll see you have to recalibrate this thing. That's the way it happens to show up on these things because of the system that we're facing SWR reading with. It's just a better way to go, bottom line, with return loss bridge, but working in DB. Okay, I think that should... I think maybe I overemphasized the take over.
Not at all. Mel and I, years from now, if we survive, will be still discussing decibels and standing wave ratio, transmission line characteristics and antenna characteristics, and lost bridges and whatever. These are subjects that keep coming up over and over again. They're highly misunderstood. The books don't make it as clear as they should. If you feel uncomfortable on the subject at first, you're in very good company. Don't let that alarm you. Hang in there. It's a good thing to learn. It'll double your salary, so to speak, once you learn it. Paul was first, and then JXN after that. So Paul, WS2N, go ahead with your question, Paul.
Okay, this is WS2N. Going back to your last statement, Dick, you said the radio I'm listening to now on is 120 dB, and everything's supposed to be related to what? DB what? Is that watts compared to my antenna or bulbs or both? Or, you know, what is that 120? And my main question connected to this 120, the statement before that, you're saying the log is, if you have three, a log of three, that's 10 followed by three zeros. Log of a million is, you've got six, because you've got the six zeros. But then what confused me was when you said, because of this 120 dB, it's now, you know, 12 zeros now. You know, where is it? I mean, I said you were going to say 120 zeros. So, you know, we went from 12 to 120. So I'm losing the multiply of 10 in there somewhere. But that's my real question. How do we go from a statement of the log for, you know, the amount of zeros is that number? We get 120. Okay, I think I'm seeing it now, staring at it, Dick. dB, decibels, not bells. That's my guess. I'm actually starting to understand this, Dick. It took me a lot of years. Back to you.
Give that man a cigar. he's getting it. Yeah, it turns out a bell named, it's a unit named after Alexander Graham Bell. It's where you take the ratio of X and Y and divide them, and you end up with a number, and you take the logarithm of that number mathematically, and the unit you come up with is called Bell, named after Alexander Graham Bell. Turns out Bell is a very big number. One bell is a 10-to-1 ratio. I got it backwards. No, it's a 2-to-1 ratio. Anyhow, bell is a very big unit. We decided to make a smaller unit to make it more convenient, so we called it decibels. We could have also made centibels and millibels and microbels. And believe it or not, I have worked in microbels, but it's an extremely rare unit. So decibels, in order to convert power of, say for instance, I'm talking about an amplifier where I put 1 milliwatt into it and 10 milliwatts comes out of it. It's got a gain of 10-to-1 in power, roughly 3-to-1 in voltage, but I won't go there. 10-to-1 in power of this particular amplifier. I take the log of that ratio, 10, it gives me a 1, and then I multiply it by 10. You'll notice that all power decibels are 10 times the log of something. The 10 converts your bells into decibels. In the case of voltage, you multiply by 20. I won't go into why you have to do that, but just take my word for it. And you're about to ask the question, if I've got 10 dB of gain of an amplifier, does that mean it has 10 dB of gain in power or 10 dB of gain in voltage? Because in the case of power measurements, I multiply by 10 times the log. In the case of voltage measurements, I measure 20 times the log. So a lot of people will ask the question, this amplifier's got 10 dB of gain, is that voltage gain of 10 dB or power gain of 10 dB? And the answer is yes to both. As long as you understand